tin box of aspirins across the oilcloth table cover. "Thanks." Susie took three and washed them down with coffee.
"He's going out collecting bugs," said Fauna quietly.
"You went over there?"
"I met him in the street."
"Have a nice time?" Susie looked up at her with eyes so wide that she seemed to be turned inside out.
"He didn't make no pass,"
she said breathlessly.
"Went out on the sand dunes, and he didn't make no pass."
Fauna smiled.
"But he talked nice."
"Didn't talk much, but he talked nice."
"That's good."
"Maybe I'm nuts, Fauna, but I told him."
"Oh, you ain't nuts."
"I told him everything. He didn't even ask."
Fauna asked quietly, "What did he talk about?"
"He said there's a fella in old times made a wife out of flowers."
"What for God's sake?"
"Well, I don't know, but it was all right when he said it."
"What else did he say?"
Susie spoke slowly. "Out in the sand dunes, I done most of the talking, but he give me a boost every now and then when I run down."
Fauna said, "He can do that better than anybody."
Susie's eyes were shining with excitement.
"I almost forgot," she said. "I never took no stock in stars and stuff like that, but you know what we had for dinner?"
"Champagne?"
"Fish and crab," said Susie, "and I didn't break out."
"Well?"
"Remember what you said? How I'm fish and he's crab?"
Fauna turned her head away.
"I got something up my nose," she said. "I wonder if I'm catching cold."
"Do you think that's a sign, Fauna? Do you?"
"Everything's signs," said Fauna. "Everything."
There was a glory in Susie's eyes.
"Right after we ate, we was talking, and he said, 'I'm lonely.'"
"Now that ain't like him," Fauna said. "That's a dirty trick."
"No, ma'am," Susie contradicted her. "He didn't say it like that. I heard that one before, too. He said it like it was pushed out of him. It surprised him, like he didn't know he was going to say it."
"What do you think, Fauna? Tell me, what do you think?"
"I think there's going to be like a new gold star."
"Well, suppose, and there ain't no harm in supposing, suppose I moved over there. It would be, well, it would be right across the street from here. Everybody knows I worked here. Wouldn't that kind of bother him?"
"He knows you work here, don't he? Susie, girl, you gotta promise me something. Don't you never try to run away from nothing, because you can't. If you're all right, nobody ain't going to tear you down. Guy that runs away, why, he's a fugitive, and a fugitive never gets away."
"How about Doc?" said Susie.
"Look, if you ain't good enough for him, he ain't good enough for you."
"I don't want to lay no bear trap for him, Fauna."
Fauna was smiling to herself. She said, "I guess a man is the only kind of varmint sets his own trap, baits it, and then steps in it. You just set still, Susie girl. Don't do nothing. Nobody can't say you trapped him if you don't do nothing."
"Well, he didn't really..."
"They never do," said Fauna. Susie said weakly,
"I can't hardly breathe."
"You know, you ain't cussed once this morning," Fauna said.
"Ain't I?"
"Some of my gold stars was damn good hookers," said Fauna. "But when I put up your gold star, Susie, the whoring business ain't lost nothing. Like the patron says, you're too small in the butt and too big in the bust."
"I don't want nobody to get the idea I'm hustling Doc."
"You're damn right you ain't. I'll see to that."
She looked speculatively at Susie.
"You know, I'd like you to get out of town tonight and kind of freshen up.
Where'll I go?
You could go on an errand for me to San Francisco if you wanted to. I got a little package up there in a safe deposit box. I'll give you some dough, and I want you should buy some clothes and a hat. Get a nice suit. It'll last you for years. Look, walk up and down Montgomery Street and see what the nice-looking dames is wearing. You know, the kind of material. They're pretty smart women up there. Before you buy, look around a little. Make it nice. Come on back tomorrow.
Susie said, "You getting me out of the way?"
"Yeah," said Fauna. "You got the idea."
"Why?"
"Susie, girl, that ain't none of your business. There's a 2 o'clock bus and a 4 o'clock bus."
"I'll take the 4 o'clock."
"Why?"
"Well, you said Doc's going out collecting bugs. Maybe while he's gone I could kind of swamp out his joint. It ain't had a scrubbing for years."
"That might make him mad."
"I'll start him a nice stew, cooking slow," said Susie. "I make a real nice stew." She came around the table.
"Get your hands off me," said Fauna. "Go on now. Don't you ever say that thing again that made a sucker out of me. My best fur."
"You mean, I love you?"
"That's it. Don't you say it."
"Okay," said Susie.
Chapter 25, Old Jingle Bollocks. Doc got back from his collecting about 4:30. He had over 100 chitons bound with string to little glass plates to keep them from curling, and submerged in seawater in his collecting buckets were hundreds of brittle stars. Now, killing is one of the delicate operations of a marine zoologist. You want the animal to resemble its living self, but this is impossible. In death, the color changes, just as it does with us. Also, if any violent means of killing is used, there is constriction, and in the case of brittle stars, the death struggle causes the animal to shed its arms. In the front room of Western Biological, Doc poured out part of the seawater from his wooden bucket. Then he moved the brittle stars to a large, flat-bottomed glass dish and poured some seawater on top of them. The little animals with the snake-like arms whipped about for a moment and then settled down. When they were quite still and resting, Doc added a little fresh water to the dish. The arms stirred nervously. He waited a while and then added a little more fresh water. To a sea animal, fresh water is a poison, and if it is slowly introduced, it is as subtle as morphine. It relaxes and soothes until the little creature goes to sleep and dies without violence. Doc sat down to wait for the poison to act. He sensed that there was something wrong. What could it be? Had he forgotten something? He felt all right. The small hangover of the morning was gone. Of course. It was the case of Bohemia beer over at the Patron's. His subconscious must have been reminding him of the beer. He looked out the window toward the grocery. And there was something wrong with that, too. And finally he saw. His windows were clean. He turned and looked around the laboratory. The records were piled neatly on the shelves, not falling all over themselves. The floor was shining, and that smell, that was soap. He moved to the kitchen. His dishes were clean, the pans scoured and shining. A delicious odor came from a pot on the gas stove. He lifted the lid. Brown meat juice bubbled up through carrots and onions, and a stick of white celery swam like a fish. Doc went back to his table and sat down. His cot was made up and smooth, and the turned-down sheet was clean. Suddenly a sense of desolation came over him, a great sadness that was like warmth. The toes of his lined-up shoes peeked out at him from under the bed. The poor kid, he thought. Oh, the poor damn kid. I wonder if she's trying to repay... I hope I haven't done anything bad. My God, I hope she didn't misunderstand anything. What did I say? I know I didn't do anything, but what did I say? I wouldn't hurt Susie for the world. He glanced around again. She sure does a job of cleaning, he thought. The stew smells wonderful, too. He poured a little more fresh water into the glass dish. The arms of the brittle stars were arranging themselves in small spirals. They hardly moved when the fresh poison was introduced. The clean laboratory made Doc nervous and apprehensive, and there was something missing from himself, something lost. The lowest voice of all was still. In his black depths he was somehow comforted. He went to the record shelf. Not Bach. No, not Buxtehude. Not Palestrina either. His hand strayed to an album not used in a long time. He had opened it before he knew what he was doing, and then he smiled and put the first record on the turntable. Mozart's Don Giovanni. It started its overture, and Doc, still smiling, went to the kitchen and stirred the stew. Don Giovanni, he said. Is that what I think of myself? No, I do not. But why do I feel so good and so bad? He looked at his desk. The yellow pads were piled neatly and the pencils were sharpened. I believe I'll try. And at that point, there were fumbling steps on his porch, and old Jingle Bollocks burst in. It is madness to write about old Jingle Bollocks, but since he came in at this point, it is necessary. People coming out of a session with old Jay felt slightly dizzy, and the wise ones, after a time, just didn't believe it. His name cannot be mentioned, for it occurs on too many bronze plaques that begin, "Donated by." Old Jay was born so rich that he didn't know he was rich at all. He thought everybody was that way. He was a scientist, but whether brilliant or a screwball, nobody ever knew, and since he had contributed to so many learned foundations and financed so many projects and served on so many boards of trustees, nobody cared openly to wonder. He gave millions away, but he was likely to sponge on a friend. His scholastic honors were many, and there were people who thought privately and venomously that they were awarded in hope of a donation, that he was, in fact, like a football player whose grades have little relation to his scholarship. He was a stubby man with a natural tonsure of yellow hair. His eyes were bright as a bird's eyes, and he was interested in everything. He was so close to reality that he had completely lost touch with realism. Sometimes he amused Doc, and at other times his endless and myopic enthusiasms could drive a man to despair. Old Jingle Bollocks shouted at everyone under the impression that this made for clarity. "Did you get my wire?" he cried. "No." "Came for your birthday. Always remember it. Same day they burned Giordano Bruno."
"It's not my birthday," said Doc.
"Well, what day is this?"
"Friday."
"Oh, well, I'll wait over."
"It's in December. I only have one cot."
"All right, I'll sleep on the floor."
He wandered to the kitchen, took the lid off the pot, and began eating the stew, blowing on it violently to cool it.
"That's not done," said Doc,
and he was irritated to find that he was shouting back. "Done enough!" cried old Jay, and went on eating. Doc said, "Hitzler came through. He said you were seen on a lawn in Berkeley, on your knees, pulling a worm out of the ground with your teeth." Old Jay swallowed a half-cooked carrot. "Not so," he shouted. "Say, this stew's not done." "That's what I told you." "Oh, well, you see, I've watched robins getting worms. Little beggars dig in their heels, so to speak. I got to wondering how much actual pull was involved. Had a scale with a clamp in my teeth. Average night crawler resists to the extent of 1 pound 6 ounces. I tried 48 individuals. Think of it. A 3-ounce bird pulls 22 ounces, over 7 times his own weight. No wonder they eat so much. Just eating keeps them hungry. Like robins?"
"Not particularly," said Doc. "Are you going to eat all my dinner?"
"I guess so," said old Jingle Bollocks. "But it's not done. You got anything to drink?"
"I'll get some beer," said Doc.
"Fine, get a lot."
"Don't you want to contribute a little?"
"I'm short," said old Jay.
Doc said, "You are not. You're a freeloader."
"Oh,"
said Jingle Bollocks.
"I said, don't you want to contribute?" "I'm a little short," said old Jay.
Doc said angrily, "You are not. You're a freeloader. You never pay. You ran the lab while I was in the army and damn near bankrupted me. I don't say you stole most of the museum glass. I just say it's missing. Did you take those specimen jars?"
"Well, yes,"
said old Jingle Bollocks. And then he said thoughtfully, "I wish you were a charity or an institution."
"What?"
"Then I could endow you," said old Jingle Bollocks. "Well, I'm not an institution. So what do? You go to a lot of trouble to keep from paying a couple of dollars for beer." And suddenly despair and humor crashed head-on in Doc, and he burst into weary laughter. "Oh, Lord," he said, "you're just not possible. You're a ridiculous idea."
"Your stew is burning,"
said old Jingle Bollocks. Doc leaped to the stove and pulled the pot from the burner.
"You ate all the juice," he said bitterly. "Of course it burned." "It was very good," said old Jay.
In the grocery, Doc said, "Give me a dozen cans of beer."
"Don't you want the Bohemia?"
"Hell no," Doc said. "I have a guest who..." And then an evil thought came to him. "A very interesting man," Doc said. "Why don't you come over and have a drink with us? My friend can explain chess to you better than I can."
"Why not?" said the patron. "Maybe I better bring a little liquor."
"Why not?" said Doc. Crossing the street, the patron asked,
"You going to the party tomorrow?"
"Sure."
"I like you, Doc, but I don't get you. You ain't real," said the patron.
"How do you mean?"
"Well, everything you do is, well, you're like that chess. I don't get you at all."
Doc said, "Do you suppose nobody's real to anybody else? You're going to meet a man who can't possibly exist."
"Don't talk like that," said the patron nervously.
Old Jay shouted as they went up the stairs.
"I bring you tidings of great joy. The human species is going to disappear."
"This is Joseph and Mary Rivas," said Doc. "Joseph and Mary, this is old Jingle Bollocks."
"Why can't you rig a chess game?" the patron asked.
"Oh, you can, you can. Or at least you can rearrange your opponent. Comes to the same thing. Now, where was I? Oh, yes. We are about to join the great reptiles in extinction."
"Good," said Doc.
You mean there ain't going to be no more people? Said the patron.
Right, young man. We have played the final joke on ourselves. Open the beer. Man, in saving himself, has destroyed himself.
Who's destroyed? The patron demanded.
There must be chuckling on Olympus, said old Jingle Bollocks. We go not to Armageddon, but to the gas chamber, and we generate our own gas.
Doc said, I intended to work on my paper.
Good. I'll help, said old Jingle Bollocks. Oh, God, no, said Doc. Man has solved his problems, old Jay went on. Predators he has removed from the earth. Heat and cold he has turned aside. Communicable disease he's practically eliminated. The old live on, the young do not die. The best wars can't even balance the birth rate. There was a time when a small army could cut a population in half in a year. Starvation, typhus, plague, tuberculosis were trusty weapons. A scratch with the spear point meant infection and death. Do you know what the incidence of death from battle wounds is today? 1%! 100 years ago it was 80%. The population grows and the productivity of the earth decreases. In a foreseeable future we shall be smothered by our own numbers. Only birth control could save us, and that is one thing mankind is never going to practice.
Brother, said the patron, what makes you so damn happy about it?
It's a cosmic joke. Preoccupation with survival has set the stage for extinction.
I didn't get one goddamn word of that, said Joseph and Mary. Doc's hands were full. In his left he held a small glass of whiskey, and in his right a can of beer. He sipped from the one and gulped from the other. Every instinct tells me to stay out of this, he said, and every impulse makes me want to get into it.
Good, said old Jay. Is that whiskey?
Old tennis shoes, said Joseph and Mary. Want some?
Perhaps a little later.
Okay.
It's a little later now, said old Jingle Bollocks.
I guess you can hustle with anything, said the patron. I got a feeling I'm being took.
Well, the impulse wins, said Doc. You've forgotten one thing, old Jingle Bollocks. Indeed, there have been species which became extinct through their own miscalculations, but they were species with a small range of variability. Now consider the lemming. That is a very specialized case, said old Jingle Bollocks. How do you know we aren't? What do lemmings do when their population exceeds the food supply? Whole masses of them swim out to sea and drown until a balance of food and population is reached.
I deny your right to use lemmings, said old Jingle Bollocks. Hand me that bottle, will you?
Deny and be damned, Doc said. Is the lemming migration a disease? Is it a memory? Or is it a psychic manifestation forced on part of the group for the survival of the whole? Old Jay howled back at him.
I will not be robbed of extinction. This is a swindle.
He turned to the patron.
Don't listen to that man. He's a charlatan.
He sure as hell is, said Joseph and Mary admiringly. Doc leveled a finger between the eyes of old Jay, holding his whiskey glass like the butt of a pistol.
Disease, you say? Infection? Down almost to non-existence? But tell me, are not neurotic disturbances on the increase? And are they curable, or does the cure spread them? Now you wait. Don't you try to talk now. Do you suppose that the tendency toward homosexuality might not also have a mathematical progression? And could this not be the human solution?
You can't prove it, old Jingle Bollocks cried. It's all talk. Overemphasis. Why, you might as well accuse me of neurotic tendencies and be done with it.
His eyes brimmed with tears.
My friend, my thought friend, my true friend,
he whimpered. Doc said,
I wouldn't even think of such a thing.
You wouldn't?
Certainly not.
When are you going to start dinner?
Said old Jingle Bollocks. You've eaten my dinner, said Doc.
I've got a fine idea, said old Jay. While you start dinner, William and Mary can get a fresh bottle of whiskey, and I'll set up the chessmen.
It's not William and Mary, it's Joseph and Mary.
Who is? Oh, my friend, I'm going to teach you the greatest of all games, the ethereal creation of human intelligence. Shall we sugar it up with a little side bet?
Why, you dishonest old fraud, Doc shouted.
$10, Mary?
The patron shrugged his shoulders in apology to Doc. You have to pay to learn things, he said.
Make it 25, old Jingle Bollock said. You want to live forever?
Doc opened a can of salmon and a can of spaghetti and stirred the two together in a frying pan. He grated nutmeg over it. Sadly, he put the burned stew pot to soak in the sink. A little after dark, the patron went back to the grocery and sent Cacahuete to deliver a third bottle of whiskey. Upstairs, he joined the wetbacks as in advancing and retreating lines they danced the sad and stately measures of the Tehuanos. Sandunga, they sang. Sandunga, mamma mia. In the darkening laboratory, Doc and old Jay went softly into the third bottle of old tennis shoes.
You've had the bed long enough, Doc said. I want it now. All right. As I grow older, I expect less and less, and get nothing, even from my so-called friends. Look here. You've eaten and spoiled my first dinner, stuffed my second, swilled my beer, taken two drinks for one of the whiskey, appropriated my bed, broken two phonograph records, and I saw you put my fountain pen in your pocket. And how you razzle-dazzled the patron out of $25, I don't know. You shouldn't have told him that under certain circumstances a knight can jump three squares in one direction. That's not honest.
I know, said old Jingle Bollocks. He patted the pillow lovingly.
Now you lie down here and get comfortable. I'll bring you a drink. Feel better now?
Oh, I'm all right, said Doc.
Say, is that place across the street still running?
A jagged rage whipped Doc upright.
You stay out of there, he said. You old fool, lie down and go to sleep. Why shouldn't I go? Am I to deny myself the loveliness of women if the price is right? I can hear the tinkle of their sweet voices and see the heaving of their white round...
Oh, shut up, Doc said.
What's the matter, dear friend? I don't remember that you ever starved for love, even when it was less near and less reasonable.
You go to hell, said Doc. But you go to hell here.
Chapter 26, The Developing Storm. At the very moment Doc and old Jingle Bollocks were quarreling over a matter neither of them understood, Mac was sitting, body comfortable but spirit disturbed, in Fauna's office bedroom. In his hand he held a Venetian glass bud vase of whiskey. He was pouring out to Fauna a problem that had not come up in his life for many years.
"Don't think that there ain't been parties before at the palace and fights," he said. "Why, when the news came that Gay had went to his reward, we give a memorial shindig that they don't hardly do no better at the Salinas Rodeo. Gay would have been proud of it if he could have got in."
Fauna said, "There's talk around that three mourners went to join Gay before nightfall the next day."
"Well, you gotta expect a certain amount of accidents," said Mac modestly. "That was all fine. But this here's something special. Not only are loyal hearts framing their dear friend for a hunk of charity, but we got a double header. Right in the palace flophouse, the holy bounds of matrimony got its spikes dug in on the starting line. This here's a halcyon brawl,
I and the boys got real delicate feelings about it.
But no clothes, said Fauna.
Right. We think somebody got to set a standard. If the loyal friends look like mugs, what'll the mugs look like?
Fauna nodded. I see what you mean. How far you want to go? Monkey suits?
God, no, Max said. Just pants and coats made out of the same stuff, and nobody gets in without he's got a necktie on. And none of them bow ties that light up, neither. This is a goddamn solemn moment, Fauna.
She scratched her scalp with her pencil. Mac went on.
I ain't as young as I was. I don't know how many more parties I can take.
Don't none of us get no younger, said Fauna. She tapped her teeth with the pencil. As it happened, she also had a problem, and she intended to ask Mac's advice. Now, suddenly, the two problems crashed together, and a solution for both was born. Into Fauna's eyes came the light of triumph as she murmured, I got it.
Give it to me gentle, said Mac. I didn't get much sleep today.
Fauna got up and found the stick with which she directed astrological traffic, or whacked a protruding piece of bad posture. She talked better with the wand in her hand. This here calls for a drink, she said, and she poured it. Mac turned the stem of the bud vase in his fingers and sighted through his drink. The red glass made the brown whiskey look green. Fauna said, There was a queen a long time ago, and she was loaded. Didn't think nothing of paying a couple $100 for a house dress. Got so many bracelets she couldn't bend her arms. You know what she done when she had a birthday or a hanging or something?
Overalls, said Mac.
No, but you're close.
Dressed like she's a milkmaid. They'd wash up a cow, and the queen'd sit on a gold stool and take a whang at milking. And there's another old dame, just the top cream of the top cream, gives them parties can't nobody get in. She wears a head rag. Done it for years. If you look over the crowd and don't see a head rag, she ain't there.
Mac's hand shook as he raised the bud vase to his lips. Is it what I think?
Masquerade! Cried Fauna. There's only two kinds of people in the world gives a masquerade. People who got too much and people who ain't got nothing.
Mac smiled inwardly to himself. Can I have a freshener? He asked.
Help yourself, said Fauna. Masquerade has got other things, too. People get kind of bored with who they are. Makes them something else for a while.
Max spoke with reverence. They used to say, if you got something you can't figure out, give it to Mac. Fauna, it's your dice. You're a bull bitch idea dame. God to dum dum his wonders to perform.
Like it?
Like it. Fauna, this here's one Life magazine would give its ass for an invite. We got to have a theme.
How do you mean?
Well, we can't let people just run wild. You don't know what kind of stuff they'd wear. I don't want no tramp and gunny sack party.
I guess you're right. You got any ideas?
How about at the court of the Fairy Queen?
No, said Mac. First place, we got no right to hurt Joe Elegant's feelings. Second place, the cop...
Well, how about then Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs?
I seen the picture, said Mac.
I think you got something. Some of them dwarfs looked like mugs. I can't see Hazel as no fairy, but he'd do fine as a great big overgrown dwarf.
That's what's nice about it, said Fauna. Give you some leeway.
Do you think this might call for a drink?
I sure as hell do. You spread the word, Mac, will you? You come either as a dwarf, a prince, or a princess, or you damn well don't get in. Hold that vase steady.
But not Doc, said Mac.
You know, said Fauna, 5 will get you 7. Doc wears a tie.
Chapter 27. Oh, frabjous day. The communications system on Cannery Row is mysterious to the point of magic and rapid to the speed of light. Fauna and Mac came to the decision that the party would be masquerade on Friday evening at 9:11 and a half. By 9:12, the magic had started, and by 9:30, everyone who was not asleep, drunk, or away knew about it. One particularly mean woman who hadn't had a man for a long time commented, "How will you know whether they're in costume or not?" A statement clearly drawn from her own state of misery, but mainly the news was received with wonder and joy. Max Tomwallinger had achieved the stature of a bull bitch Tomwallinger. Consider what was in store for the ticket holders. A party at the Palace Flophouse, a raffle that amounted to a potlatch, an engagement of exciting proportions unknown in the annals of the row, and on top of this, a costume party. Any one of these would have been enough. Together, they threatened to be a celebration close to a catastrophe. Fauna breathed a sigh of relief, for it solved her greatest problem. She wanted to dress Susie in a certain way, and Susie, being the tough monkey she was, would have resisted. Now it was easy. There's little difference between the wardrobe of Snow White and that of a lovely young bride. There will be those who will consider that Fauna took too much upon herself in engineering a marriage without the knowledge or collusion of either party, and such skeptics will be perfectly right. But it was Fauna's conviction, born out of long experience, that most people, one, did not know what they wanted, two, did not know how to go about getting it, and three, didn't know when they had it. Fauna was one of those rare people who not only have convictions but are quite willing to take responsibility for them. She knew that Doc and Susie should be together, and since they were too confused or thoughtless or shy to bring about that happy state, Fauna was prepared to do it for them. Her critics will cry, "Suppose she's wrong. Maybe this association has no chance of success." And Fauna's answer to this, if she had heard it, would have been, "They ain't doing so good now. It might work. What they got to lose? And when you look at it, what chance has anybody got? Doc put on a tie, didn't he? And if I'm wrong, it's my fault. Sure, they'll fight now and then. Who don't? But maybe you'll get something, too. What's the odds for anybody?" And if it was suggested that people should have the right to choose for themselves after thinking it over, she would have replied, "Who thinks? I can think because I ain't part of it." And if she had been accused of being a busybody, she would have said, "Damn right, done it all my life." You couldn't win an argument with Fauna because she would agree with you and then go right on as she had planned. She had taken up astrology because she found that people who won't take advice from a wise and informed friend will blindly follow the orders of the planets, which, by all reports, are fairly remote and aloof. Doc would refuse astrology, so he had to be sandbagged. Fauna expected no thanks. She had given that up long ago. Doc could not interpret the black voice of his guts, but it sounded loud in Fauna's ears. She knew his loneliness. When she was with him, that low voice drowned out all the others. On Saturday morning, she made every girl in the house bring out every article of clothing she possessed and lay it on the bed in her office. Now Mabel was a natural-born, blowed-in-the-glass hustler. In any time, under any system, after a period of orientation, Mabel would have found herself doing exactly what she was doing in Cannery Row. This was not a matter of fate, but rather a combination of aptitudes and inclinations. Born in a hovel or a castle, Mabel would have gravitated toward hustling. The heap of finery on Fauna's bed was impressive. Some of those dresses could have got a girl booked for vagrancy just going out to mail a letter. Mabel took Fauna aside and spoke to her privately. "My grandma come from the old country," she said when the door of her room was closed. Mabel opened the bottom drawer of her bureau and lifted out a brown paper parcel sealed against air with strips of cellophane tape. "Grandma left it to Mama, and Mama left it to me," she said as she tore the paper. "We ain't none of us needed it." She removed layer after layer of tissue paper and at last spread a dress out on her bed. A wedding dress of sheerest white linen, embroidered with sprays of white flowers, stitches so tiny they seemed to grow out of the cloth. The bodice was close-fitting and the skirt very full. Mabel opened a box and laid beside the dress a silver wedding crown. "I guess she wouldn't hurt it none," said Mabel. "Tell her not to spill nothing on it. I'll polish up the crown. It's kind of tarnished. Real silver." Fauna was speechless for once. Her fingers went to the light and lovely fabric. She was a hard woman to break up, but the dress nearly did it.
"Snow White," she said breathlessly. "I better be careful, or I'll get to believing my own pitch. Mabel, I'm going to give you my jet earrings."
"I don't want nothing."
"You want my jet earrings?"
"Ah, shoot," said Mabel. "Looks like it might nearly fit her," Fauna observed. "Well, we can kind of tack it where it don't."
"You know, you're a good girl. You want I should go to work on you?"
"Hell no," said Mabel. "I like it here. There's a veil, too, in this here bag."
"I don't know if we can get away with a veil, but we'll try," said Fauna.
"Oh, hell, she don't know a veil from a hole in the ground," said Mabel.
If only people would give the thought, the care, the judgment to international affairs, to politics, even to their jobs, that they lavish on what to wear to a masquerade, the world would run in greased grooves. On the surface, Cannery Row was quieter than usual, but below the surface it seethed. In one corner of the palace flophouse, Whitey Number 2 gave careful lessons to little Johnny Carriaga in the art of palming cards. Johnny had been borrowed for the occasion, or more truthfully rented, since Alberto Carriaga had received 62 cents, the price of a gallon of wine, for the use of his firstborn. It was planned that Johnny should be dressed as Cupid, with paper wings, bow and arrow, and quiver. The quiver was added as a hiding place for the winning raffle ticket, for although nearly everyone on the row knew the raffle was rigged, a certain pride made it necessary to carry the deception off with dignity. Because of a small distrust of Johnny, the arrows in the quiver were tipped with rubber suction cups. Whitey Number 2 had cut a card the exact size of a raffle ticket. "Now try it again, Johnny," he said. "No, I can see the edge of it. Look, sort of squeeze the edges in your palm like this. Now try it again. That's right, that's good. Now, let's see you get it out of the quiver. You make a pass with the bow, like this, so they look at your other hand, and you say..."
"I know," said Johnny. "I'm Cupid, god of love, and I draw a bead on unsuspecting hearts."
"God, that's beautiful," said Eddie. "I wonder where Mac got that."
"He made it up," said Whitey Number 2.
"Now when you shove up the bow with your right hand, you get the ticket out of the quiver with your left. Try it."
"I am Cupid, god of love," said Johnny, and he brandished the bow.
"That's good.
said Whitey number two. It'll take a little more practice, though. Don't look at your left hand, Johnny. Look at the bowl. Now, here's the bowl. Dig around the cards without dropping the ticket. Go on, practice.
I want 35 cents, said Johnny.
What?
If I don't get 35 cents, I'll tell.
Mac, said Whitey number two, this here kid's jumped the price.
Give it to him, said Mac. I'll flip him double or nothing later.
Not with that two-headed nickel you won't, said Johnny.
Seems like kids got no respect for their elders nowadays, Eddie observed. If I ever said that, my old man would have clobbered me.
Maybe your old man wasn't rigging no raffle, said Johnny.
Whitey number one said, this kid ain't honest. You know where bad kids go, Johnny?
I sure do, and I've been there, said Johnny.
Give him the 35 cents, said Mac.
What hidden, hoarded longings there are in all of us. Behind the broken nose and baleful eye may be a gentle courtier. Behind the postures and symbols and myths of Joe Elegant, there may be the hunger to be a man. If one could be, for only an evening, whatever in the world one wished, what would it be? What secret would come out? To a certain extent, the theme of the Palace Flophouse raffle and engagement party was chosen because of Hazel. He was definitely dwarf material. But when he had reviewed the story, asked questions, and got as clear a picture as he ever got of anything, Hazel elected to be Prince Charming. He saw himself in white silk knee-breeches and an Eton jacket, his left hand fondling the hilt of a small sword. They offered him Grumpy, lovable old Grumpy, the prize part of all. They offered him Sweet Pea the skunk, but Hazel stuck to his dream. It was Prince Charming, or he wouldn't attend. Friendships have foundered on less.
All right, said Mac. You go ahead. I was going to help you with your costume, but I know when I'm stumped. Hazel, if you're Prince Charming, you're on your own.
Who cares, said Hazel. Who wants your help? I'll bet you're mad because you wanted to be Prince Charming.
Not me, said Mac. I'm going as a tree.
How do you mean?
It's a forest, ain't it? Said Mac. I want a little anonymity. You can't see the tree for the forest.
Hazel went to sit under the cypress tree. He was gloomy, and he was frightened because ideas did not come to him, and when he sought them, they ran screaming away. But he was determined. He could not let the office down. A man sentenced to be president could not go as a dwarf. It wasn't dignified. Later in the morning, he went to the back door of the Bear Flag and called for help from Joe Elegant. Joe smiled.
I'll help you, he said maliciously.
All over the row, trunks were being opened, and the smell of mothballs penetrated as far as the middle of the street. And all over the row, the story was being rewritten to fit the wardrobe. By unspoken agreement, no one planned to be Snow White. In Western Biological, Doc awakened, racked with pain from sleeping on the floor. He lay still for a moment, trying to isolate the part of him that hurt most. Not the least of his agony was his memory of forcing old Jingle Bollocks to take his bed, a crazy, alcoholic generosity, probably masochistic in origin, had prompted the sacrifice. He raised up on one shattered elbow and looked at the old bastard sleeping so sweetly, his halo of yellow hair surrounding his polished pink pate, his breath puffing in small, comfortable snores.
"Wake up!"
Doc shouted in fury. The pale eyes flickered.
"What's for breakfast?"
said old Jay.
"Don't you even have the decency to have a hangover? "Certainly I do," said old Jay with dignity. "How's about some beer?"
"Does your head ache?"
"Yes."
"Do your joints ache?"
"Yes."
"Do you have low blood pressure depression?"
"Overwhelming."
"Then I've got you," said Doc. "You get the beer." The pale eyes rolled despairingly.
"I'll pay you half if you get it."
"No."
"Tell you what I'll do. I'll loan you the money."
"No." Old Jingle Bollocks' eyes were bleak.
"Reach me my pants," he said,
and he fished out a quarter and a dime and held them out.
"No," said Doc. "God in heaven, what do you want?"
"I want $2.
"Why, that'd be 6 bottles.
"Exactly. You're trapped, old Jingle Bollocks, and you know it." Old Jay dug deep and found 2 $1 bills.
"Maybe I can write it off to entertainment," he said.
Doc pulled on pants and shirt and went across the street. He took his time. He drank a bottle of beer quickly and then sipped a second while he heard the news of the day from Joseph and Mary. Back in the laboratory, he put the 4 cold remaining bottles on the table.
"Where's my change?" asked old Jay.
"I drank your change," said Doc. He was beginning to feel good. He saw the stricken look. "You cheap old fraud," he said happily. "For once you've been had." And he went on. "I wish I could understand you. You must have millions, and yet you pinch and squirm and cheat. Why?"
"Please give me beer. I'm dying," said old Jingle Bollocks.
"Then die a little longer," said Doc. "I love to see you die."
"It's not my fault," old Jay said. "It's a state of mind. You might call it the American state of mind. The tax laws are creating a whole new kind of man, a psyche rather than a psychosis. 2 or 3 generations, and we'll maybe set the species apart. Can I have beer now?"
"No."
"If a man has any money, he doesn't ask, 'Can I afford this?' but 'Can I deduct it?' 2 men fight over a luncheon check when both of them are going to deduct it anyway. The whole nation conditioned to dishonesty by its laws, because honesty is penalized. But it's worse than that. If you'll just hand me a bottle, I'll tell you."
"Tell me first."
"I didn't write the tax laws," old Jay said, trembling. "The only creative thing we have is the individual. But the law doesn't permit me to give money to an individual. I must give it to a group, an organization. And the only thing a group has ever created is bookkeeping. To participate in my gift, the individual must become part of the group and thus lose his individuality and his creativeness. I didn't write the law. I hate a law that stifles generosity and makes charity good business. Corporations are losing their financial efficiency because waste pays. I deplore it, but I do it. I know you need a microscope, but I can't give it to you because with taxes, a $400 microscope costs me $1,200 if I give it to you, and nothing if I give it to an institution. Why, if you, through creative work, should win a prize, most of the money would go in taxes. I don't mind taxes, God knows, but I do mind the kind of law that makes of charity not the full warmness of sharing, but a stinking expediency. Now, if you don't hand me a beer, I shall be forced—"
"Here's your beer," said Doc.
"What's for breakfast?"
"God knows. The party at the Palace Flophouse tonight is a masquerade. Snow White and 7 Dwarfs.
"Why?"
"I don't know."
"I shall go as a red dwarf,"
said old Jingle Bollocks. "A dying star," said Doc. "It kind of fits you with that hair." When the beer was gone, they decided that beer made breakfast redundant. Doc went back for 6 more bottles, and in a burst of generosity, he brought back the Bohemia.
"Now there's beer for you,"
said old Jingle Bollocks. The Mexicans are a great and noble people. The Pyramid of the Sun and this beer, whole civilizations have produced less. You started to tell me about your paper last night, but you got deflected by a girl. I'd like to see that girl.
I'd like to tell you about my paper. I want to draw some parallels between emotional responses in cephalopods and in humans, and I'd like to observe the pathological changes that go with these responses. Now, the body walls of octopi are semi-transparent. With proper equipment, it might be possible to observe these changes as they happen. Sometimes the simpler organisms can give us a key to the more complex. Dementia praecox, for example, was considered purely a psychotic manifestation until it was observed that there were physical symptoms as well.
Why don't you write your paper?
I seem to be afraid to. A kind of terror comes over me when I start.
What have you got to lose if you fail?
Nothing.
What have you got to gain if you succeed?
I don't know. Old Jingle Bollocks regarded Doc benignly.
Have you got enough beer in you so you aren't quarrelsome?
I'm never quarrelsome.
The hell you aren't! Took my head off last night. You hurt my feelings.
I'm sorry. What did you want to say?
Will you let me finish if I start?
I'll try. Old Jay said,
You feel to me like a woman who has never had a baby but who knows all the words. There's a lack of fulfillment in you. I think you violated something or withheld something from yourself, almost as though you were eating plenty but no vitamin A. You aren't hungry, but you're starving. That's what I think.
I can't imagine anything I lack. I have freedom, comfort, and the work I like. What have I missed?
Well, last night, in every conversation, a girl named Susie crept in.
For God's sake, said Doc, do you know what Susie is? An illiterate little tramp, a whore. I took her out to dinner because Fauna asked me to. I found her interesting the way I'd find a new series of octopus interesting, that's all. You've always been a goddamn fool, old Jingle Bollocks, but you've never been a romantic damn fool.
Who's talking about romance? I was speaking of hunger. Maybe you can't be wholly yourself because you've never given yourself wholly to someone else.
Of all the esoteric goddamn nonsense, Doc cried.
Why I give floor room to you, I don't know. Then try to figure out why you get mad, said old Jay.
What?
Well, aren't you putting a lot of energy into denying something which, if it's not true, deserve no denial?
Sometimes I think you're just plain nuts, said Doc.
Know what I'm going to do? Said old Jay. I'm going to buy a bottle of whiskey.
I don't believe it, said Doc.
Chapter 28 Where Alfred the Sacred River Ran. Very few people know that Hazel had given the palace flophouse its name years ago when the boys had first moved in. Inspired by the glory of having a home, Hazel compounded the name of something he knew about and something he didn't. The known and the unknown, the homely and the exotic. And ever after, the name had stuck, so that it was known by certain people from one end of the state to the other. And the palace flophouse had justified its name over the years. It had been shelter and home base to the boys. Also, some surprising events had occurred there. The building itself was not impressive. Redwood board and bat, tar paper roof, 28 feet long, 14 feet wide, 2 square windows, and 2 doors, one on each side. Into this simple box, Mac and the boys had moved some remarkable articles, the product of their wits, their work, and sometimes their misfortune. The great cast-iron stove was in excellent condition, and bid fair to outlast the Colosseum which it resembled. The grandfather clock, once the home of a dog, stood empty now, and Eddie wanted to be buried in it. Each of the beds was canopied as a substitute for mending the roof,